This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, not my face in the mirror. This episode is the second part of my conversation with the poet Vivi Francis. So if you haven't listened to part one yet, you should hit pause and listen to that first. It's titled Salvation in the Dark. If you're ready for part two, let's get to it. Vivi and I had just spent almost 2 hours talking about her latest collection, Forest Primeval, when I asked her what she was working on now. A memoir, she told me. And then we talked for an hour more. No poems, no scripted questions, just us talking about the memoir and about what's haunted her for much of her life.
So the memoir is called Ugly, and that's the immediate consideration as having been called ugly all of my life. So I have body dysmorphic disorder, which concentrates on my face. So it's not considered curable. I've had difficulty accepting my face, tolerating my face for most of my life now. I've had therapists work with me before I think they realized what the disorder was. And for a long time, I was able to say, I'm not ugly. Those people out there, the external world, finds me ugly. But I could maintain my sense of who I was. And then I had a breaking point. It was simply one time too many. So for, I would say, maybe the past 7 years, I went from being able to tell myself that I was still maintaining that self to when I just let go, I couldn't fight it anymore. I didn't have the means to fight it anymore. I just said, okay.
Yeah.
And it entered me like a snake moves down a hole, as if there were other snakes already there to wrap around.
Yeah.
So the things that had been told to me, really at the intersection of race and aesthetics, being thought of as ugly by my own culture and then the regions I'm from, and being told that I wasn't aesthetically sound by, I'd say, the white world at large. And I'm very specifically saying the white world.
Yeah.
Within the U.S. I can't speak for outside of the U.S. because my experiences outside of the U.S. have been extraordinarily good.
Yeah.
But I do know that I'm not alone in these experiences outside of the U.S. I know that others outside of the U.S. have gone through what I've gone through. But I do think that many Black women have body dysmorphic disorder. I think they don't know it. And I think they fight it in many of the ways I've fought it. But I lost my fight. And I want to talk about that loss in the memoir. But something happened too, and that is I have freed myself of white aesthetic notions completely. And I freed myself of anyone else's aesthetic notions. I have a hard time not finding people aesthetically pleasing. I see beauty everywhere. And it's like a gift. After something was taken from me, it's like a gift. So when I'm at conferences like AWP and several times women younger than me in their 20s and 30s, and they've read my work and they just want to hug me. And I was really shocked by this at first, but then I realized a lot of the young women looked like me. They were similar.
Yeah.
And it gives me so much pleasure to just hug them up. And when I look at them, they know I'm looking at them as if they are desserts on a tray. Delightful. and beautiful, and that it is not lip service for me.
Yeah.
And the world gives women like me so much lip service. And it's not beauty for a political cause, not black is beautiful because I need it to be, but black is beautiful because it is. Mm-hmm. And so is everything else to me. So it's hard to explain the humans in their beauty, in their physical aspect, delight me. And
yeah,
I don't know if there's something that the wider world says that makes that person unbeautiful or anything but beautiful. That's not what my eye's going to see. And I can't really explain it better than that right now. But I think, I you know, in the air, I'm less articulate than I am on the page, hence being a writer.
Well, I thought about beauty so much throughout my life. One of the reasons is that I had anorexia for a really long time, and it was haunting me for...
Yeah, that's a type of body dysmorphic disorder that, you know...
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
But I've often felt like there is an inequality that we don't even talk about, that we just sort of blanket cover with these platitudes, you know, like, oh, but you are beautiful. Oh, but you aren't fat. Oh, but, you know.
Doesn't it just make you crazy?
It really does.
They're meaningless, and they actually do so much more harm than good.
It's like saying to a poor person, like, oh, but you are rich, or like, you know, one day you'll be rich, you know. It's like, well, you're actually actively harming the situation because you're not willing to look at what is causing some people to suffer under these inequities and some people
yes.
to reap benefits undeserved. And that equality that you talk about, where you just have broken free from this hierarchical thinking about it, and that you see the physical aspect of people, everyone, as nothing but beautiful. I so relate to that, you know, that what makes us beautiful is not like, you know, wherever, like how symmetrical our face is, or how, you know, whatever all the things are that we tell ourselves.
The so-called science behind symmetry.
Yeah.
That I could exactly. talk about that forever, that it angers me. It so
yeah.
angers me. Every time I read those studies, I think, oh, I hope I never meet this person because they infuriate me so much. But the cost for that freeing was not being able to see myself. When I see pictures of myself, I can fall into despair for days. It's a phenomenon. I'm trying to remember who. Here's a study that I did find fascinating, that if someone has anorexia, you can tell them all day long, you're not fat, but when they're looking in that mirror, that is what they see. And the reason, science, is there's a neurological shift that forces that side. And I know exactly what that shift is because I was undiagnosed. I couldn't figure out what was happening to me. What I saw in the mirror was not what other people saw, but it wasn't spoken aloud. And because people were calling me ugly, I read that as monstrous.
Mm.
And one day I had a therapist and I was looking in my mirror and I saw an average woman, just a woman like any other woman. The face didn't look like my own at all. And I was looking in my mirror. And I called my therapist and said, it's finally happened. I've fallen into pathology. I'm no longer neurotic. I have pathologies. I've had a breakdown because I didn't see my own face in the mirror. And the therapist said, this is the first time you're seeing your face. You didn't have a breakdown, you had a breakthrough.
Yeah.
And that has happened once in my adult life. It may have happened more than once, a glimpse, but really only once that I actually recall knocked me to my knees seeing this average woman. And I was so happy to find out that, oh, I'm just an average looking woman. I was so happy to see that and not the monster that I usually see. But a lot of the book is a pushback for the kinds of platitudes or, you know, just think better about yourself. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Oh, that's the worst one. What are you talking about? Don't engage it.
I've had friends who've taken my picture and I didn't speak to them for months because I've told them, don't take my picture. Don't send them to me. I can't always tell how I'm going to react. So be protective of me.
Yeah.
And I don't put my own picture on the backs of my books. I simply, although lately I like costuming, I like aesthetic play, and that's new for me. And I'm modeling an incredible writer that I met down in D.C., I think. She had a marvelous way of dressing and her holding herself, but she was outside of this kind of elusive standard. And I just started asking her about herself. And she said something so unusual to me. If you don't free yourself, who's going to free you?
Yeah.
And she meant to free me from these aesthetic bonds, these chains around myself. And I was so moved. She just like took me aside and just said that quickly. And I don't know if she'd even remember that. But, you know, it was one of those things that changes your life again. And since then, I've been able to have some fun with styles and stylization that kind of buffer me a little bit.
Yeah.
But will I ever be healed from this? No. And the book talks about that.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's one of those things. I at least that's, you know, in my experience, you know, you have to learn to manage. But yeah, I don't think it can go. But one of the things that have helped me, and I'm wondering now if it would help you, because it's harder to do with a face, but one of the things that have helped me is tell myself, you know, my sister is beautiful. My body looks like my sister's body. I can't go as far as to say then, you know, therefore I am beautiful, but I can say, therefore I should stop piling all this hate onto my own shape. You know, I can go there and I can keep looking at her and project, you know, try to replace what I see when I look in the mirror with what I see when I look at her. And so I'm wondering if there's someone that you trust, you know, like your husband or good friend or who you could ask, like, okay, you know, is there someone that you think looks like me?
You know, this is wonderful. These are techniques I've started. I know that I look like my cousins. I look like my younger sister. It's funny you said sister. Mm-hmm. My younger sister, whom I adore and spoil, and she's in her 40s. I think she's just into her 40s. Mm-hmm. So I shouldn't spoil her, but I do with my adoration. And I look like my aunts on my father's side. All of my aunts are beloved to me, but I look like my aunts on my father's side.
Yeah,
I don't look like my mother's side at all, and my mother was considered a beauty. But I love their faces, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm always wanting to give them little kisses on the cheeks. I love their faces. but I can't see mine well enough. I know intellectually that I look like them, but I can't see it. And my husband, he does tell me, but I also have a chapter on this. My husband was too late. He came too late. And the break was too severe.
Yeah.
If you don't mind me asking, how old were you when you first realized that this was anorexia?
14.
Oh, that's very young. Yeah.
Yeah. And I spent many, many, many years recovering from it. I mean, even though physically I recovered, you know, I regained my weight after a year and 5 months or something, the dysmorphia, it stayed for like a decade and a half after my early 30s. And I feel also, I mean, it's interesting that you say that you've recently started to play with style and all of that, because I've radically sworn that off, and part of that is self-protection, you know. Part of that is just like, I don't even want to have to look in a mirror. I don't want to, that's just a part of life that I'm not going to do, because it's a world of pain, and why, you know. But now that I'm growing older, and you're going to laugh, of course, because I'm what, 38 or something, but you know, I'm starting to have gray hair, I have these lines in my face, you know, something has changed. I'm like, oh, I feel like a cooling of my own hatred, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. And you don't want that to happen in your 50s. You want that to happen now. I wish that some of the things I understand now, I would have understood in my 30s. I'd have saved myself some pain. I find that I'm able to help my students. I've had several students who suffer from it.
Mm.
But I understand it. I absolutely do. And they're surrounded by people who encourage the dysmorphia. And that's almost criminal to me.
Yeah.
But I do think that my students know that I'm not participating in that. So several of them have trusted me, and I'm grateful for that. And it's helped me too, because they don't look at me. I can tell from the way they look at me that they're not seeing me in the ways I was taught to see myself.
Yeah.
Because this was taught to me. This wasn't something I wanted. It was taught and reinforced by billboards, by television, television is something else. That's something that's changed remarkably too.
Yeah.
My husband said last night, I was streaming late last night. I worked all day and I just wanted to zone out. And my husband said, little Vibe could never have imagined the television show you were just watching. I said, no, I couldn't have. Because there was a black protagonist, a woman, and there are so many models and persons, and you know, the world has changed quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's, you know, that's like when I see, what are they called, Generation Z, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ways that they embrace, I don't know if you're on TikTok, but like, it's life-giving, you know, the people that are on there and, yeah, expressing themselves, so many different bodies, so many different faces, so many different kinds of expressions.
I love that. I love it. And again, that's something, the aesthetics were so narrow when I was born and as I was growing up, but this is not something I ever expected, and the thrill of it is my husband is significantly younger than I am, and normative for him is just I'm like, wow, how fortunate are you?
That's amazing.
So this is too why I can't feel despair around political and social situations, because that kind of generosity, that kind of openness, that kind of non-competitiveness is a kind of power. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the generations coming up are going to tolerate some of the things that are being forced upon them by an older generation. I think that they are powerful enough to reject some ideas, and I've rejected.
Yeah.
Several of the ideas I grew up with that I find untenable and ungenerous. And I thought when I first started talking about some of the concerns of the memoir, I thought only young Black women would respond, but the responses have been from women all over. And many women who one might look at and think about the protean standard and say, oh, well, this is clearly a beautiful woman. But the women who are writing to me, they're really writing about crushing social expectations. And that was stunning to me. I'm not alone. All women are really under the wheel that they can't even describe. They don't even know why. From the day they're born, they're put under that wheel.
Yeah.
And it's crushing. And now I see the wheel. So I don't feel just despair. I feel, I won't say I feel hope. I feel inevitability.
Oh, that's better than hope.
Yeah. Things cannot be sustained as they were. And so I'm not saying there won't be more violence, but I am saying that whatever comes is inevitable. And I need to embrace the world around me. I hunger to do that.
Yeah.
Which is hard to do with extreme judgmentalism and narrow aesthetic tendencies. It's hard to do that, but it will take more of my life to be able to extend that to myself. But
you still have a lot of life left.
Well, let us hope so.
touch wood.
my uncle, great uncle Elijah is turning 101 this week.
Wow.
My father's side of the family is from a part of Texas where the Black people live longer than most other Black people in the country. And so let's hope there's a lot left. I'm hoping so.
And how far along is your memoir? I mean, like when do you think, or are you still writing it and you're not at all in the phase where you can talk about dates and stuff?
Well, no, I can't talk about dates yet, but close to done. Taking bits of it and they'll be coming out in different venues in the next year.
And given that it's not out yet and that it's not even on any kind of publication calendar yet, would you prefer me not including any of this part of the conversation?
Oh, no, you can.
Okay.
Okay. I can't say where in the progression it is. I can just say that things are coming along.
Yeah.
And I'm excited.
Yeah. Vivie Francis's memoir will be titled Ugly. She also has a new poetry collection in the works titled The Shared World. If you want to start reading right now, She's the author of three poetry collections, Forest Primeval, which won the 2016 Hurst and Wright Legacy Award for Poetry and the 2017 Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, Horse in the Dark, which won the Kaveh Kanem Northwestern University Press Prize, and Blue Tail Fly. Frances is the associate editor at the literary journal Callaloo and associate professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College. She lives in Vermont with her husband, the poet Matthew Oldsman. To find out more, check out the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.